Good morning, everybody. I think it's time to start. It's 5 minutes past. It's not an academic quarter, but still. My name is Pavel Havrilag, and I am with the Institute for Microstructural Sciences, National Research Council of Canada in Ottawa. And I wasn't sure how to arrange this, but in some sense, I am also a resident experimentalist here. So I will tell you about an effort that's going on about the physics of spins in quantum dots and what I know about it, both theoretically and experimentally, as we work together with experimentalists.
Who knows more than you about quantum dots?
I don't know. All right, so I will try to go very quickly through spin in lateral gated dots. I will talk a little bit about the spin blockade spectroscopy, single spin transistor, and a little bit touch on spin orbit interaction. I am in your way, maybe if you move. Okay, you don't want to see. Okay, so then I will, since Gerhard is not here, but I was supposed to mesh with Gerhard, then I put in a little bit on self-assembled dots and what are the theoretical challenges there and how spin orbit interaction manifests itself in self-assembled dots. And I would like to spend most of the theoretical time on quantum dots with magnetic ions and how we can use carriers to control and mediate Mangan-Mangan interactions. All right, so let's talk about these single spin electronics. So I think we are pretty familiar with this technique. It's been pioneered by Andy Zahrida. It's a special design of gates on top of heterostructures, and using the special design of gates, you can localize and control a specific number of electrons, 0, 1, 2, 7, 20, 100, whatever. The most important thing of this design that distinguishes these lateral dots from vertical dots right now is that on top of control over electron numbers, one can, which allows you to localize a single electron and it carries a spin, one can connect this dot with spin polarized leads. And the way we are doing it right now is by applying a small magnetic field. So if you apply a small magnetic field, you create edge states in your contact, source and drain. So you have a blue is, for example, up and red down. And now, if you have these edge states, they are different for different spin components. And now if you try to tunnel an electron through a resonant level through a quantum dot, then it will be sensitive to the spin of an electron inside. And so you can think of having another tool, spin blockade spectroscopy. By sending spin polarized electrons through a quantum dot, these spin polarized electrons will be directly probing spin in a quantum dot.
But why? Mm-hmm. They are moving around.
They are moving through a resonant level. And they are moving through a resonant level. So a small spatial so the question is, we have a resonant level. If it's empty, then what electrons are tunneling through this level? The ones that are tunneling through a smaller barrier will have a small barrier, very large difference in probability amplitude, so we will have spin polarized current. And if I put an electron here with the same spin, the exclusion principle.
Maybe I don't understand the figure.
Okay.
It's right that the current is going around the dot.
Yes.
And not through the dot.
Yes.
Why?
Yes, but the
is some component of the current.
Yes, of course. So without applying a source-drain bias, there are no electrons tunneling through this resonant level in a quantum dot. But one applies a small bias, and then electrons go from the edge states in the source to the edge states in the drain, as was illustrated by this arrow moving from.
So there should be transverse trajectory.
It's a trajectory that takes us from here to here through the quantum dot.
Yes.
Yes. A thought.
So to get the spin selectivity, minimum magnetic fields, how big is that magnetic field?
Half a Tesla.
So you can study spins in quantum dots and fields bigger than half a Tesla.
We can study, yes. An ideal case would be to build a ferromagnetic source and ferromagnetic drain. And we have actually tried to do this in vertical quantum dots. So far, no success. So, yes?
You're trying to probe the electron in the dot?
Yes.
Well, why doesn't it just tunnel out? I mean, it's part of the current also.
No. No, the tunneling can only take place if maybe we will get through this. Well, actually, we can start and stop with a single transparency. So, if we, depending on the on these, I go through the gimmicks here and go back to this picture. Yes, so you control the minimum of this potential. So you control the minimum of this potential with respect to the Fermi levels of source and drain. Yes, and that stabilizes the electron number. And current doesn't flow. The number of electrons is conserved. They just sit there. No, but the current will flow when the chemical potential of the quantum dot is equal to the chemical potential of the leads. Then you can have an exchange of carriers. And that's why that's the essence of Coulomb blockade spectroscopy, that you align the chemical potential of the quantum dot, okay, with the chemical potential of the leads, then carriers can flow. And so that can only happen at discrete values of the gate potential that controls the depth of this potential here. Okay? So, for example, this gate here is a plunger gate, and this gate will control this depth of the potential by a little bit. Okay. All right. How can we go through this fast? So by having this dot connected to spin-polarized leads, we can send electrons with a definite spin. And this is naturally a tool, a spectroscopic tool that allows us to sense the spin of electrons on the dot. Okay. All right. So in order to move a little further, we need to understand something about the electronic levels of a quantum dot. So we have a Hamiltonian, it's a harmonic oscillator, two harmonic oscillator, two different frequencies, Fock-Darwin spectrum, including Zeeman energy. And I just wanted to point to something that I will be doing later, that I will just select the lowest Landau level spin split states at some fixed value of magnetic field and pick up the lowest second Landau level, which is here in green, and draw them in this way. So it's a fixed magnetic field, and now I draw them instead of vertically, I tilt them. Because the lowest one has angular momentum 0, second angular momentum 1, 2, and 3. So this is implicitly an angular momentum of these states. Okay? And the only thing we need to remember is that there is another ladder of green states, and I only want to think you to think about this green one. All right? These Fock-Darwin spectra are not a figment of imagination. You can measure them, and I will talk about this later. All right, so we have our dot. We put a single electron in this dot. And if we have only one electron, it will naturally relax to the lowest energy level, so it will be sitting there. Now, we can grow a droplet of electrons, which is a spin singlet droplet. It has no spin, nothing. It's just a tool for us to move an electron of interest, a spin, to some predetermined orbital. Yeah? So by growing this droplet using gates, we can put this extra spin to one of those orbitals. Of course, it's a quasi-particle and so on, but it's sitting in one of those orbitals at the Fermi level, and these orbitals are at the edge of this droplet, and they look something like this. They are little cylinders, okay, with a radius that is controlled by the orbital number. So now we have another tool, which is our green orbital, and we can lower the energy of this green orbital with respect to the Fermi level, and then we can, this orbital is actually at the center, it has a p orbital, so it has a zero in the center, but then it's a fairly well localized orbital in the center of the dot. So we can now transfer this electron from the edge to the center of the dot. So we transfer at the Fermi level, we transfer geometrically from the edge to the center. That's very important because we couple to the edge differently than we couple to the center.
How,
yes?
How do you lower the magnetic field?
We change the magnetic field, yeah.
Don't you also
The Zeeman energy is there, but Zeeman energy is not important. It's a very small energy on this scale. So how can this be put to use? It's very simple. Let's just remember about this spin that we isolate in our droplet, and it's sitting on a red orbital. This red orbital is at the edge, so it's coupled to the source and drain. And there is a green orbital, which is in the center, so it's very weakly coupled to this source and drain. And so think of it as an artificial atom. And if I have an electron here, I have spin-polarized source and drain, then naturally, I apologize because this is for high school students, so an electron cannot go. But if I move this electron from this edge orbital into the center orbital, then of course I open the channel without changing any charge, just changing the spin, effectively the spin of the quantum dot, and the current will flow. And so that's the basis of this switch. You know, it's not at where, not at room temperature, it's not at zero magnetic field. Come on in, come on in. There's plenty of room here in the front row. you ask a lot of questions, so we need you here. All right, so here is you dial in an odd electron numbers in your quantum dot. For example, 16 plus 1, yes? And you have one electron at the edge orbital, and it's connected to spin-polarized lead, and this is an amplitude of a current, and this current, this amplitude is very low. Now you change the magnetic field across this line, which means we moved our electron to the center orbital, yes? And the current is high. So you switch the amplitude of the current. Nothing really moves significantly. This is a gate voltage. This is magnetic field. So you need to adjust the gate voltage just a little bit. But you switch the magnitude of the current by an order of magnitude by just moving the spin in a quantum dot. All right. So far, so good. Yes, you can ask, please.
The difference between the red and the green levels is not the orientation of the magnetic moment.
No. It's different orbitals. Lowest lambda level orbital. They are not spin polarized. Well, there is spin there. Yes, actually, when we move an electron, there is also when we move an electron, it also becomes spin polarized. It's a little more complicated, but with one electron, it doesn't matter. So you move an electron, well, it's a finite magnetic field. It's pointing down or up, depending on the G factor. We can tune the G factor and Zeeman splitting by changing the depth of our confining potential in the vertical direction.
I thought that mm-hmm. there is some relation
very small coupling or an effect of leads at the condo level on the levels of a quantum dot, but it's very, very small. It is a very, very small effect.
Sorry, can you kill the previous sign?
All right.
Where's the odd even effect?
There is an odd even effect. So here it's low, here it's high. Pardon me?
So if the electron is sitting in the orbital, which is at the edge, why can't it go out to the drain and then from the source alone is coming in?
Okay, this will go back to explaining one more time how you go through a quantum dot. So you the current flows when you are adding an electron to a dot. So we are talking about an electron that was already there, not an electron that was added. So you need to put, you need to put here a spin singlet. Okay, you need to add to flow to have current going through at this gate voltage. You would need to put here an electron with spin up, and then it can go through. Okay. But a spin down electron cannot go through, and it could only go through the next level. It's at a very different gate voltage. It's over there, and so on. But
Because of charging energy,
It's not you should not think about it that one electron that for an electron to come in, an electron has to leave. No, you go in, you added an electron. There are now two electrons in the dot, and one of those two electrons is leaving. Okay, that's the picture. All right.
I also have a problem with in this question. Actually, why the second Landau level is so important? Because of changing the wave function inside and changing the overlap integrals, or for some different reason. Because what even you can do with electrons from the same Landau level.
Yes, yes.
So what is the role, critical role, of the second Landau level?
It's because you are removing an electron from the edge of the droplet to the center of the droplet.
Overlap
integral. Very small.
And it is important for transparency.
Yes. Yes.
For collecting the transparency.
Yes. Yes.
And why, in a non-interacting picture, you remove two electrons at once? Right. So is it some charging effect that...
Why do I remove two electrons?
There are two states available in the higher Landau level.
Two states available in a higher Landau.
Spin state.
Yes, but we are sending spin polarized electrons. That's the whole point. Whole point is that the dot is connected to spin polarized source and spin polarized drain. We can only spin down electron can go. It can only go through one of those levels. The other one is not available.
100%?
It's not 100%. You see here, you see a current here, you see a current here. The difference is pretty large, an order of magnitude, but there is no such a thing as 100% in a lab. Okay, so we can do it differently. We can just go slowly through this, or we can do this a second time maybe, or do this privately. What I thought was that this time I would just show some things, and then whoever is interested, we can go for coffee and do this on a blackboard. But there are two ways, and each one is as good as the other. Because right now I am at 1/10 of my presentation and in half of the time. So. All right, you don't want to hear about magnetic ions.
No, that's the third part.
Okay. Well, Gerhard is here. So we have been working on controlling the spin, and we work a lot on spin textures, but it's complicated. I'm not going to talk about. I just want to talk a little bit about spin orbit interactions in a two-electron complex, and that's simple. So when we have two electrons now, and they sit on the s orbital, and this is the one of the p orbitals, then as we change magnetic field, we change interactions, and we can induce a singlet triplet transition in a magnetic field. And these two states can be probed by doing source and drain spectroscopy. So if you open the voltage across the source and drain up to some value delta V, then within this window there are excited states that you will send current through those excited states, and you will see them. This one is, yeah. And so this is a result of Andy's experiment, and what you see here is you see here a singlet state and you see here a triplet state, and they come together. And there is a transition between singlet and triplet, yeah, somewhere here, pointed by this arrow. So you have a singlet-triplet transition, and until this transition, you see both singlet and triplet, and after this transition, you don't. And that's an illustration of spin-orbit interaction. Why is that so? Well, we have both Dresselhaus and Rajba's term, and if we look at the Rajba term, then it involves spin operators, yes? So sigma x. So sigma x operator will flip the spin. So if an electron has spin down, it will have or if it has spin up, it will have a spin down. That means that if I have a SZ equals 0 2 electron state, it has to end up in a spin polarized state as z equal 1 through spin orbit interaction. Spin orbit interaction doesn't do anything in the transport process. You need to take energy by phonons, but it mixes the states and allows for spin relaxation. So up to this point, we see triplet as an excited state. From that moment on, triplet is the ground state, but singlet is gone. And the way we believe it works is that until the singlet-triplet transition, you see that you have three triplet states, and they are relaxing to the singlet. Out of those three triplet states, one state, SZ equals 0, cannot be coupled to an SZ equals 0 singlet state, and therefore cannot relax. So electron comes in into this triplet state with SZ equals 0, it stays there and comes out of this state, and we see it in transport. Those that come in other triplet state will relax to the singlet and come out as a singlet. So, of course, it would be nice after this crossing, there is always a relaxation challenge of an excited state, and so we don't see it. Okay, so yeah. And does it depend on spin then?
It doesn't. It just depends on the number of available states in the door.
So,
not all that happens for whether the rotation happens. I mean, you can also see orbital charges.
So, what you do is you reverse the bias.
Yes.
And if you see the same picture, you know it's not related to the thickness of the barrier. So this is not related to the thickness of the barrier. This repeats itself for higher electron numbers. It also appears in vertical quantum dots. It seems to be related to the singlet-triplet transition. Have a singlet-triplet transition?
Well, in
you see the singlet after that.
Okay, I'm not sure whether you...
It's very, very weak. So,
we did not do this. If you say you reverse bias, yeah. You see the both ways.
Yeah, and you see this for 8 electrons. You see this for higher electron numbers when you go through this new equal to state. So, it would be nice to actually resolve all the triplets to understand exactly what's happening at the singlet triplet transition and so on. But potentially, this is a manifestation of spin orbit interaction, that through spin orbit interaction, the interaction is different. It depends on the relaxation processes, depend on the spin of the ground state. And if we change the spin of the ground state, we change the relaxation processes, and perhaps that's what we see. But who knows?
It's relaxation from singlet to one of the components of triplet.
It's always there. But one of the triplets will not relax to a singlet, and that asymmetry is there. Now, whether this is what explains our experiments, well, okay. All right. So I will just briefly show you what we are doing with those devices. We are all familiar with the model of a quantum computer. So you need a qubit. Yes, we can put a single electron there. We can put one in a double dot, just like Delft and Charlie Marcus group, and we can study its dynamics. We can put a second one and study dynamics, and now we can put a third one, and this is done by combining lithography and impurities that are in the wafer. So you can choose your gates on top of where the impurity is, and impurity potential gives you another localized minimum, and you can construct a triple quantum dot. And you see here a triple quantum dot because you see here in this charging diagram one line, another line, and another line. So you see three lines you are adding to three localized regions.
So is it now not polarized
links,
but with
normal links? We don't know that. This is not with transport. The triple dot is not with transport. So the difference we have done, all right, so we have done, as you see, this is a device that has a quantum point contact. So For a more complicated gates, it's difficult to do transport. Correct me if I am wrong, but we have not been able to do transport. This is in the one electron regime in a double or triple dot. These are charging. So this is a quantum point contact, and you sense charges in your dot, and this is a charging diagram. Okay, this is not a transport diagram. We have done transport and demonstrated spin blockade spectroscopy in a double dot, but with electron numbers of the order of 10 per dot. Then Andy can do transport. I should correct myself. All right, so we have a triple dot, we have a complete analysis, we have a 1-1-1 region where we have one electron here, one here, one there. We can bring it into resonance, we can move electrons in this triple quantum dots and so on. All right? So, this was about lateral dots. Gerhard was talking about self-assembled quantum dots. He was talking about dots that grow by themselves on, for example, indium arsenide and gallium arsenide. And he was also showing a way of growing individual dots. Here is a single indium arsenide dot grown on a nanotemplate. Here is an array of those dots grown on a ridge. And this is our artificial atom factory. And the nice thing about these dots is that these are indium arsenide, indium phosphide dots, and that they emit into a silicon fiber. So dots on indium arsenide are very nice. They are beautiful for first principle studies, experiments. The photons are confined to your optical table. These dots, once we harness them, you can send a photon from Santa Barbara to Ottawa and back. All right. Problems. Now, if you have a quantum dot and it has probably somewhere of the order of 100 atoms in one direction, 100 atoms in another direction, 100 atoms in a third direction, it's three-dimensional, you clearly quickly get to 10 to 6 atoms. What are the energy scales? Well, you have gaps of the material you are putting the dots together, the barrier and the dot and the material. Indium arsenide is 0.4, gallium arsenide is 1.5. So you want to capture in your theory something of the order of electron volt. Then you have strain effects. They shift the gaps by about half an electron volt. Okay? So very big effects. So mixing of two different materials, big effect, strain, very big effect. Then you want to capture a spacing of the energy levels that Gerhard was drawing, and in a conduction band it's about 50 millielectronvolts, so it's about 0.05, yes? So we are going from 1 by 2 orders of magnitude. Then valence band is even smaller spacing of levels. Then you have splitting of shells. If you have geometries, you have degeneracies, the splitting of those degeneracies, that's much smaller energy scale. Then you have a fine structure in the exciton exchange interaction and so on. That's much, much, much lower energy scale, microelectronvolts. So you have all these energy scales that you want to capture for a structure that's at least thousands of atoms or millions of atoms, sorry. You also have things you don't know, which are intermixing effects and shape and size effects. So it's a complicated problem. And some of you who are computationally inclined might want to take up this problem. So we have about a million atoms, and what are the tools available to understand electronic properties of systems? Well, you know, you can maybe try to do configuration interaction on oxygen. Eberhard Gross says that the memory required for an oxygen atom exceeds the number of bits exceeds the number of atoms on Earth. I mean, this could very well be, but that's the kind of quantum mechanical calculation at the one atom level that you could do. If you could collect all the sand from the beaches of Santa Barbara and use it as bits. So, density functional, Giovanni, correct me, about hundreds of atoms, yes, maybe 1,000? Yeah. All right, you can do density functional, you can do GW, calculate quasi-particles, then make let these quasi-particles, electrons and holes interact to Bethe-Salpeter equation, so you can put maybe hundreds of atoms and plus one exciton. You can do pseudopotential, but how to treat excitations, you can do tight binding, again, how to treat excitations, you have K.P, effective mass, and so on. So there are different tools, different levels of complexity, and different levels of approximations that we are making. What we are doing actually is the following. We start with a model of the nanostructure. It's an atomistic model, so we put these atoms. Okay, then we minimize we find their position by minimizing strain. So either through atomistic or continuum strain calculation, calculate their equilibrium position. But we assume what these atoms are and where they are to begin with. So we don't allow them to move to find some other equilibrium.
Neutral position remains the same.
Topology remains the same. Yeah, they maybe move a little bit, but they cannot. We cannot have a redistribution of these atoms to have them more indium atoms migrate to the top and then to the bottom. No, we start with a composition and we minimize the strain. Right. And that's about maybe a billion atoms that goes into these kind of calculations. Then we do electronic structure through atomistic tight binding calculations or effective mass or K dot P, and we put spin orbit interaction into these tight binding calculations at the level of individual core atoms. So X, one of the P X orbital spin up will be coupled to a Z orbital spin down, for example, and this gives you a spin orbit coupling at an atomic level. And then once we know this relevant single particle levels, maybe 10, 20 of them out of a million or several millions, then we do quasi-particle calculations. We calculate excitons or multi-excitons, many electrons, configuration interactions, Hartree-Fock and configuration DFT and so on. And then a series of experiments are being addressed by these calculations. Okay, so this is very complicated, but can one understand some of these experiments that Gerhard was talking about? I mean, he's completely unconcerned by these kind of theoretical difficulties. He leaves us alone and to struggle with it. He says, this is a simple model. I can draw my potential couple of levels and then put particles there. Everything works. Why is that so? Well, because it's true that in the end you will get some confined energy levels, and the physics becomes quite simple. Okay, now quantitatively that's a different story, but qualitatively we can understand a lot of physics of those structures based on simple models. And this is an example. If you take this Fock-Darwin spectrum that I used for my lateral device, where I cannot measure directly the single particle spectrum, so if I take this Fock-Darwin spectrum for electrons and for holes, and now if I populate electron levels and I populate hole levels, then by optical selection rule, which will connect the same level in the valence band with the same level in the conduction band, and I can reduce this complicated spectrum into a combined spectrum, a spectrum of photons. So electron hole pair spectrum leads to a photon spectrum. This actually is a K dot P calculation, one of those, discretizing million atom or million size orbital structures and plotting it as a function of magnetic field. And you can measure it, and I showed you already the result. Yeah? So there are lots of interesting things here which are related to interactions, but in general, this is your Fock-Darwin spectrum. So an ensemble of million quantum dots behaves like one or two harmonic oscillators in a magnetic field. And so it works.
But the axial symmetry is broken in self-assembly. It is something like Egyptian pyramid.
No. No. You anneal these dots. These dots are annealed. They don't like to be pyramids. Okay? If you take a pyramid and you expose it to sun and wind, it becomes a lens.
Yeah.
All right? And so,
there
you go. So, and when you cut a quantum dot, and if you anneal a quantum dot, you are exposing it to these external elements. Nobody likes to be, nobody likes sharp edges. So you end up with something that looks like this quantum dot.
I have two questions. This concerning the structural relaxation. would you get out from your calculations the shape of the quantum dot, like the pyramid as the...
No. No. So this is a you need to do kinetical Monte Carlo calculations, and we have not done that yet. Okay. So what we do is we assume the shape and composition. We calculate the high excitation spectra. We compare the spectra with calculations. There are some ways in which you can limit your shape and composition and find a class of quantum dots that fit a series of experiments, and then you. With also structural characterization, you have some confidence, and in the end, you may not have this confidence and still do physics.
And then my second question was concerning the external magnetic field.
Yeah.
You don't include that in your calculation.
We do.
Do you do it?
Not within density function, within this effective tight binding calculation. Okay. So then you have prior substitution for hopping matrix elements. Okay, so one manifestation of that Michael Flatte also worked very, very nicely, and that has to do with spin and orbital angular momentum. And so, as Michael explained during the conference, photon angular momentum has to be a difference between initial and final angular momenta, initial and final states, and holes have an angular momentum which is orbital plus spin, where orbital is equal 1, they're mostly p-like, and electrons have also total angular momentum, but L is equal 0, so they are mostly spin-like. And so, if you have a flat structure like this one, maybe more like a disc-like. This is really a sort of a lens where we actually chop off a top, and we do this with atomic precision. With atomic precision, we can control this height in an NB system. And so, because it's flat,
it means that in two different lengths, different kinds
of dots,
self-assembled dots are used in Ottawa. These kinds
yes.
of dots.
He's in Munich, but these are almost the same dots, the same material parameters. But then there are ingenious MB growers who come up with different tricks to make these structures better. If you just took ensemble of dots, indium arsenide dots, and try to do these magneto-optical measurements, the spectrum of which I showed you, you would see nothing. Okay? So this is not something that you grow the dots, you put them into, you go to Grenoble or you do your first experiment in Ottawa and you have good samples, you go to Grenoble, you go up to 28 Tesla and you get the Fock-Darwin spectrum. That's not exactly how it works.
But one experimental comment, it's surprisingly controlled to,
yeah.
To get a certain shape. It depends on the world conditions. When we started this in 1996 or 7, we used the exact recipe which we got from Pierre Petro from here. And we got basically the same luminescence spectrum.
I think in 96. Not 8.
1996, right. And so we just used the recipe from here, rose temperature, and transferred it to the system in Munich. And the samples look very similar when you find them. When you change the parameters, but it is surprisingly good under control.
Yeah. But there are other tricks that you can do that Zbigniew Wasilewski, for example, here with Simon Fafard came up with this idea of indium flash technique that what it does is allows to control the height, and the height variations in height control the volume of the dot, and the variation of energy levels is inversely proportional to the cube of the dimension, so inversely proportional to the volume. If you control the volume variation very well, you control the inhomogeneous grouping of your line, and that's the trick, plus annealing, plus couple of years and couple of students. Anyway, the point is here that if you have flat structure, which has much larger dimension in the plane and in the height, your spin of the hole is going to be frozen in the growth direction. We know this from quantum wells too. Yes? It's either plus or minus 3/2 plus some admixture of light hole. And so, but the electron spin, okay, the electron spin is in any direction. So if you apply magnetic field and you tilt the magnetic field, then you can tilt the electron spin, but the whole spin is frozen, and you can control the polarization and intensity of emitted photons. So there is one way of really using the spin-orbit interaction, geometry of the structures, to control spin to photon transition. Okay, now maybe 10 more minutes and I will be done. So this is, I think, an area that I am interested in and that I would like to work on while here, but so far have not been successful. There were lots of distractions. That has to do with quantum dots which contain magnetic ions, and you can think of combining magnetic transport and optical properties of semiconductors with magnetism. You can think of controlling magnetism on nanoscale, and you can think of putting magnetic moments in controlled electronic environment. Don Eigler is putting magnetic ions on the surface of metal, and this is his controlled environment, and that's very beautiful spectroscopy. This work has been done with Fania Okyu, who was on sabbatical from Brazil with me. And so the idea is to have some number of magnetic ions and then flood this localized area with electrons. And there's a lot of interest in this field. It's really stimulated by experiments from Grenoble, where they have been able to put a single magnetic ion in an individual quantum dot. And mangan is a spin 5/2, so it has 6 possible states. This is a photoluminescent spectrum. If you count the number of lines, it's 6. That's why people were so excited. I was actually interested in magnetic dots long time ago. This is a 91 paper. And
what material was that
graph? This was cadmium telluride, 2-6. So I was interested in semi-magnetic quantum dots quite some time ago, as you can see, and so it's a pleasure to come back to this. There are two types of classes that people are looking at: indium arsenide, gallium arsenide quantum dots. And I was very excited to hear from Gerhard about silicon germanium. We also have a group at Dalhousie working on silicon germanium with mangan structures. So it would be interesting to see how things develop. And typical 2-6 cadmium telluride. In this material, mangan is a deep acceptor. Here, mangan is an isoelectronic impurity, so it's an easier system to work with. I am working on this problem with Jacek Kosut from Warsaw, and the way they are growing this structure is they start with zinc telluride, then they put a cadmium telluride layer on zinc telluride, add to it a cadmium manganese telluride layer, so there is some dilute concentration of mangan, and they overgrow it with cadmium telluride, and so dots form, and in these dots there is some number of magnetic ions. But at the moment there is no control over these distribution of magnetic ions. So hopefully one can come up with some ingenious methods, perhaps this nanopatterning that allows us to fix the position of quantum dots, and then with a very dilute deposition of mangan ions, one can perhaps insert in a controlled way a single or two or three mangan ions into quantum dots. But I don't have an idea how this might work. But we have some ideas, but we will see how this works. There is lots of work in different places: Notre Dame, Grenoble, Warsaw, Würzburg, and so on. There is lots of theoretical work. Alan has done lots of work. There are very nice papers by Fernandez Rozier and Louis Bray. Sasha Govorov is doing very nice theoretical work. Shunjen Cheng, Sasha Efferson, and Emmanuel Rajba have a very nice paper, and I think this is a, you know, expanding area. All right. Well, you see an emission from an exciton. An exciton is in a dot, and it's interacting with the mangan, so they both have to be in a dot.
Mm-hmm. You still see some sweeping. because, of course, the exosome has a wave function spread out, that even if the manganese is flying around, you still would see the SD exchange.
Oh, you see, this is a question to experimentalists. This is not done in our lab, so I cannot answer for those experimentalists. But, you know, you see very nice emission line. The number of peaks is equal to the number of mangan components. So you can think of a quasi-particle that is entangled with a mangan spin, and it must have the spectral weight where the mangan states are. And so it must be there. But there were lots of control experiments. Statistics, yes. Here we have two.
And then they look at the single dots across the field. And if they look at some dots, they the spectrum looks at the not directing the dots as easily there. But they decide from the experiment that they have now attracted the single manganese.
I think in the last 2 years there has been a tremendous progress in the growth, from what I hear, both from Jacek Kosud and Furdyna and Henri Mariette. The progress is exponential right now, so I think we will see lots of labs producing dots with controlled number of mangan ions in it. And so the point is what can we do with those systems? And what I am interested in is to look at these mangan ions in a quantum dot and load this dot with electrons, okay? And so this dot has degeneresis, and this loading with electrons leads to a change of total electron spin. So if I put here one electron, the electron spin is also one half. If I put a second electron, I am filling S shell, and there is no total spin. So it's if I didn't put anything as far as spin is concerned. And if I put more, I can generate a total spin one, on a P shell, and so on. And then a higher spin in a D shell. And so I have a system of mangan ions, and they are interacting with a spin which is controlled by a gate voltage, a spin of electrons. And the total spin can be controlled through electron exchange interaction through Hund's rules. So you can have a spin of one half, no spin, large spin, three half, one, spin one, and so on. Right now, I am just feeding the electrons without any mangans, and then I will turn on interaction. So my point is that we have a problem of some number of mangan ions. I will look at one or two, which are interacting with a electron spin. So this is a composite spin of electrons, but it's tunable with gate voltages. It's tunable with the number of electrons. But of course, I don't only tune the spin itself. The orbital part is very different when I go from one spin to another. So let's look at how these electron spin changes the interaction between mangan ions, or how is it interacting with a single mangan ion? Can we understand this in some simple terms? So my Hamiltonian is very simple. I have one mangan, second mangan. I have interaction between those mangans, antiferromagnetic. Then I have interaction of each of those mangan ions with electrons. And this is, of course, not only through spin, but through also orbital degrees of freedom. So there are standard condo-like components. You will have a scattering between different electron states without flipping spin, but in a field of a mangan ion, or you will have a scattering between different orbital components, but flipping the spin and flipping the mangan spin. So standard Fondo-like Hamiltonian. And of course, then you have this spin-conserving scattering, and you have spin-flip scattering, and of course you have electron-electron interaction. So it's a strongly interacting problem of interacting mangan ions and problem of interacting electrons and everything interacting together, and I have to speed up. So 90% of what we do is on this transparency. We generate all the states, we calculate the matrix elements of this Hamiltonian. It's a little tricky problem because there is quantum physics here, there is disorder, there are electron-electron interactions. One nice thing is that you can really do in a quantum dot quantum engineering of this electron-mangan interaction. So one electron, we have our scattering matrix elements which depends on the position of the mangan and orbitals involved. And it's a local interaction, so it will directly probe the orbitals from which we scatter and to which we scatter at the position of mangan. And so you can change this by varying the size of your quantum dot. J will be inversely proportional to the size of the quantum dot. The smaller the dot, the bigger the interaction. You can vary these orbitals involved by varying the Fermi level. You need to scatter from a filled state to an empty state. You change the Fermi level, you change the orbital. So you can really engineer, and of course you can change the position of a mangan ion. So here, if I have such an interaction, when I put one mangan ion what have I done? When I am moving mangan ion away from the center of the dot, of course this interaction strength decays because this involves an S-like orbitals. If I have an interaction on the P orbitals, then it's a little different, because P orbitals have nodes, and so there will be no interaction if my mangan ion is here, and this interaction will have nodes if I move in the perpendicular direction. And if I go to another orbital, then the situation will be different. But there will always be a node. In a sense, only one P orbital can couple to an electron. So J directly probes the wave function and all these nodes. So I have one mangan and I have all these electrons depicted here by the spin. What's the interaction? What's the effect? One would like to think that the effect on the system is to change its energy by some effective coupling proportional to the product of total electron spin times total mangan spin, from S dot M interaction. So if S grows, if S changes according to Hund's rule, this energy should oscillate following Hund's rules. Yes? That's not the case. It's complete cancellation of electron-electron interactions. So if this was true, then my change in energy, this interaction should oscillate like this. We maximum at partially filled shells where total spin is maximized. But it's not doing so. It's completely flat on a given shell. It's constant. Okay? And that's a complete cancellation of
energy. That's something like Russell Saunders, or how it is called. If electron-electron exchange is stronger than the exchange to manganese ion. And what are the real numbers? What kind of spin?
This is an excellent point. This is why I am here. I will have to look it up. I have an explanation for it, but I don't have time to give it to you. So there is a cancellation of electron-electron interaction effects for a single mangan interacting with electrons, and this cancellation is controlled by gate voltages, by the number of electrons you will put in these dots. And now, what do these electrons do to the mangan-mangan interaction? If I want to have many mangans, I first need to understand what happens to the two mangans. So that's the case of two mangans and one electron spin, which is a composite. And so we can classify this situation into two cases. One is when we have closed shells. There is no electron spin, we have RKKY interactions. We derive the form of these RKK interactions. We have partially filled shells, we have finite electron spin, we have magnetopolarons, sort of many particles interacting magnetopolarons. We have a third case where no simple analysis works. We have a completely strongly coupled system and none of these approaches work. That we will not talk about here. RKKY interaction, you want to reduce your Hamiltonian to your antiferromagnetic original interaction of two mangans, and then carrier-induced interaction which is a function of position of the two mangas, and it's a standard form M1 dot M2, and the question is, what is this JRKKY? And it turns out, surprisingly, at least to me, because such an inhomogeneous system, that one can derive an analytical formula. It's written here. Okay? And it has to do with the simplicity of the wave function. So you can actually work out, this is obtained in second-order perturbation theory. Yeah? So you will have, this will be proportional, inversely proportional to the spacing of levels. So there must be 1 over the spacing of levels here. It has to be proportional to, in a second order, to J. Okay? And it has to be, this J has to be, because it has wrong units, it has to be divided by the area of the quantum dots. So sort of J is the volume, like exchange constant has to be times the thickness here. And it has to be divided by the area of a quantum dot. So one can derive an analytical formula for the strength of this interaction, and then you have dependence on positions, and so these dependence on position depends on the number of shells. So this is for 2 electrons sitting in an S shell, and now depending on to how many shells they scatter, they will interact through these terms, and of course there will be an exponential decay of this strength when both mangas are moving away from a quantum dot, this interaction has to vanish.
So that's for a parabolic shape.
This is for a parabolic quantum dot, yes. So if you take this, so if you have this form of the interaction, can I go back to this? If my 2 mangas, one is in the center, second one is somewhere up to a certain radius, critical radius, then interaction is ferromagnetic. If I move it outside, it's antiferromagnetic. So depending on where these mangas are, the interaction will be either ferromagnetic or antiferromagnetic. You can do this also by looking at mangans somewhere else. Here again, it's ferromagnetic. When you put this mangan to the other side of a quantum dot, it becomes antiferromagnetic. You can tune the form of this interaction with the number of electrons in a quantum dot. That you have to do numerically. And so you have maps of the interaction in a quantum dot as a function of position of these 2 mangans, and you know what the interactions are. Okay, you can also look at this magnetopolaron problem. I will not go through this. You can have the simplest case is when I have just 1 electron. When I have 1 electron, okay, and one can calculate with this 1 electron 2 spin positions coupled to the total mangan spin. You can ask what total mangan spin minimizes the total energy, and there will be a total energy that as a function of mangan that corresponds to some critical value of M, and you can find that these values are controlled by different coupling constants, and you can have ferromagnetic counted of antiferromagnetic situations, and you can work out this polaron energy. It is non-monotonic as a function of distance because there are 2 competing length scales. One is short-range antiferromagnetic interaction, another one is long-range ferromagnetic interaction, and you can do this for a different number of electrons and so on. And I want to thank my colleagues from the theory group, experimental groups, and our colleagues from Dortmund and Grenoble for the collaboration. Thank you for your attention.
These types of theoretical predictions, as they depend so sensitively on where the mains are located in a particular dot, you're not going to know unless you take it apart.
So that's a good point. One has to. So first of all, we learned that we can have. Let's say that we can tune the interaction from RKKY to the polaron one, like perhaps that's something that we have learned that I didn't know. Well, you know, one could anticipate it, but I didn't know exactly how this will work. One learned that these interactions depend sensitively on the position, so you have positive or negative. Perhaps what I am hoping for is that we will use optical tools to probe these effects of manganese on, for example, exciton, trion, or bi-exciton emission, and we go from a polaron to RKKY regime, and then perhaps this this position of a second manganese ion will not be that important. I don't think we will be taking it apart. I think we will. We have learned that there is.
I'm just trying to figure out what other handles you will have. We get, given that it's there's even now disagreement about whether the dots are curvilinear or lens-like, to some extent, that's been resolved largely. I mean, that's a gross feature of the dot. People still argue about exactly how asymmetric they are in one direction versus the other. Knowing where the two manganese would be in a dot, I'm just curious about how that.
Well, I am hoping that one will be able to actually implement some sort of a local atomic MBE like Michelle Simmons is doing in Australia, where you actually put dopants in a specific location, or maybe you can do this with an STM. Like Don Eigler and create a corral. So perhaps there is a hope for actually engineering structures to start with that will have a designed mangan positions. An alternative is to simply measure, probe these dots, understand how many mangans we have there, and then compare with different theoretical predictions that depend on mangan position, and in this way learn something about the stack.
And if the first part was just being polarized leads, right. Parallel obvious, of course. Do you see any chance to make them anti-parallel relative to each other so that you can induce some spin accumulation on the dot?
Well, not with this technique. And not with this technique. We are working on an alternative approach, but an ideal case would be to replace the 2D electron gas lead with something ferromagnetic. Whether this will solve the problem of changing the magnetization.
We also think using different edge channels, numerical 1, numerical 2, the up and the low, or something like this, I don't know.
Yeah, we would need to reverse effectively a G factor that that somehow would require a quantum well that has a different depth to start with. Yes? So a part of a quantum well has one depth, another part has a different depth. So you go across the energy where G factor in gallium arsenide changes sign. But how do you integrate it in the plane? It's a good point. We have been thinking about it, but obviously made no progress. So come and talk to me.
So when you talk about studying these dots experimentally, mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Which dots?
Absorption? The manganese one, say.
So I think that that the first experiments that will be done will be, well, the experiments that are done now by Jacek Kosut in Warsaw and Lucien Bezom in Grobe, optical experiments. So these are first experiments. They have no control over carriers, so they can control the number of carriers optically. That's my goal. Next goal is to understand how these ideas will work in optics. The second part of experiments which will take place is probably capacitance spectroscopy, because this is a natural type of spectroscopy. Put a gate, dope substrate, and put carriers there. And so we worked out a spectral function of those carriers that are coming into the quantum dot. As a function of mangans being there. When electron comes into the dot, it becomes entangled with mangan, and its spectral function splits into into lots of spectral pieces that that are responsible for, that are due to the mangans there. So I think the capacitance spectroscopy and tunneling spectroscopy seem to me to be first thing we would try after optics. Emmanuel.
In the hierarchy of the energies, which you have shown us at the beginning, the energy of the strains is the second largest, and also because annealing is produced. Why do you think that there is no dislocation loops?
Well, first of all, I have not, I cannot think of dislocation loops in a sample that shows a very good PL spectrum, you know, emission spectrum, because dislocations are sinks for carriers. If you have lots of dislocations, your carriers recombine non-radiatively on those dislocations. And Gerhard, correct me here.
If you have closed conditions that the silence get too large, then you get this dislocation.
Right.
Very easy. So you have to stay small enough with the islands.
So for small dots, energy of dislocations is too high.
It's too high. Yeah.
And I think annealing relieves strain. So the annealing actually is a natural way of preventing.
Without producing dislocation.
Without
producing. Because usually strength.